From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, the power of myth and the obsession with reinvention. First in line for an extreme makeover, Macbeth.
The notion is that we should somehow restore the reputation of Macbeth. We should rescue him from the clutches of the Scribbler of Stratford.
And popular culture critic Camille Paglia in just a moment. Also, the quest to define the real Marilyn Monroe.
Norman Mailer, I think, sums it up the best because he was the most kind of caught up in her image. And he says sex was dangerous with others, but it looked like it would be ice cream with her.
And fewer daggers, more dough. One man gives Macbeth a comedy makeover.
Is this a dagger which I see before me? Or a pizza?
In the world of cultural criticism, the name Camille Paglia tends to inspire controversy, awe, and respect, all at once. Paglia's made a name for herself as an intellectual champion of pop culture. Her latest book is called Break, Blow, Burn. And Strange Champs invited Paglia to the studio to talk about the human obsession with makeovers and the irresistible urge to create myths.
Americans have always been interested in self-invention. The country itself, you know, has created itself out of the wilderness of the New World. And because of our distance, I think, from European history with all of its burdens and all the, you know, the blood-soaked soil of the past there, there's a sense of always beginning anew. It's almost a kind of primal innocence. There's a naivete in it. So that, you know, the recent manifestations that we might see around us in terms of makeover shows on television, I think are just variations on a very, very long American theme, going back to Puritan New England.
That's fascinating. So is this simply the modern expression of the perennial American pursuit of happiness?
Yes, it's an idea of starting over. You know, when the Puritans arrived, the Pilgrims, I mean, they were dissidents who left England and went to the Netherlands and came here and are literally looked at America as a kind of blank slate where they could create their own utopian dream. And we just see that theme so entrenched in American history. In the 19th century, there were a whole series of utopian romantic communes, most of which ended in bitterness and in misery. You know, we see the utopian dream flaring again in the Woodstock generation, you know, that I belong to, you know, the whole idea of Woodstock Nation, and, you know, for a few short days, you know, there was a vision of peace and harmony. And then, of course, within 4 months, there was the Altamont concert in California where the people were beating each other with pool cues and a murder was committed in front of the stage as the Rolling Stones performed and so on. So we're always, seems to me, veering optimistically upward in America, trying to begin again with some often unrealistic hope, and then crashing downward into ruin.
You call this an example of American naivete, and I know probably Europeans would see it that way, but why? I mean, what is naive about the desire or the belief that you can endlessly remake and reinvent yourself?
Well, I think because everyone who arrived here, except for Africans, okay, who were kidnapped and transported here, everyone else who has arrived in the United States has come here with a vision of starting over. And so we have a kind of compulsive autobiographical streak also. You know, people will say about Americans, wherever they are in the world, that the first words out of their mouths will be like a long, you know, recitation of who they are, what they do. And so when you meet Europeans, it could be years before you really know intimate details about them, before you're invited to their personal homes. You know, people could be dying of illness around you in the workplace and you would never know it. But in America, you just sit on a bus and you hear strangers talking to each other and there's like this litany, the recitation of their ailments, their children's ailments, et cetera, et cetera. So I think it's part of the, you know, we're sort of free agents. I think that the entrepreneur spirit, you know, in America that has been so profitable, you know, for business and for new ideas, including right now with high tech, you know, this country has a genius for high tech. Even our young people, you know, 15, 16, 17, are pioneers of the web. You know, our hackers, you know, are able to break into the military industrial complex, you know, and so on, and are arrested by the police. They turn out to be 16 years old and so on and so forth. I mean, we just have this adventurous spirit as individuals. However, you know, this radical individualism also can, you know, make us perhaps amoral in terms of our sense of global citizenship. Okay. I think there is a kind of, you know, brashness and impulsiveness, you know, sometimes a depthlessness, okay, about our, you know, me first, me, the American egomania.
Mm-hmm. this endless drive to, you know, to remake yourself, to start over. It's also surely fueled by American consumer capitalism because, you know, convincing people that they need to be made over is a way to sell endless products since, you know, by definition, you're never finished. You're never done. It's always time to begin again.
Well, that's a very excellent point, but I would sort of flip it around and say that the reason, you know, consumer capitalism has flourished here, all right, is because of our radical individualism, all right? And the voice of advertisement is very brash. It's the Whitman voice, you know, it's sort of like, I am here, I am now, I sound my barbaric yawp, you know, over the rooftops of the world. That's from Leaves of Grass. So I come from an Italian immigrant family, and from my earliest years, I heard that the voice of advertising as somehow uniquely American. I love it. I mean, sort of, it's ingrained in my mind, you know, the kind of hectoring sound. It's a very theatrical sound of American capitalism.
We've been talking about contemporary manifestations of, you know, the desire to create yourself. But you can even see this makeover impulse in how we treat history. I mean, for instance, we're always redoing historical figures. Oh, you know, we're rediscovering Abraham Lincoln, uncovering new things about him, and Marilyn Monroe, the Brontes. I mean, why do we even do that historically?
Well, celebrities are very important in America, and we've our celebrity culture, which we see around us right now, in sort of a very diminished form, because our celebrities are very small compared to the celebrities of the past. I mean, I think it's part of our, you know, search for role models, our attempt to create a history when we had none. This is a very, very young country compared to Europe or let's say the Mideast, you know, whose history goes back thousands and thousands of years, and, you know, it's full of warfare, etc. And so there's just this, you know, we're always looking for the guiding spirit. That's why the founding fathers have been so sort of divinized in American political history. And then there's this contrary impulse also to tear them down and to find the flaws, to debunk, okay, which is a modern style of biography that we can see as early as Lytton Strachey, let's say, in his treatment of Victorian idols in the Bloomsbury period in the 1920s in England. But so we have the whole culture is in this strange, almost like kind of sadomasochistic pattern of idolatry, you know, followed by sort of a sacrificial martyrdom of the celebrity. And then, you know, if the celebrity is strong enough, he or she will make the comeback. Okay. And we see that pattern throughout the history of Hollywood. Elizabeth Taylor, my particular favorite from my youth, is a good example of that. You know, she was the child star, much beloved, a beautiful, nubile teen. Okay. And then embarked on a series of marriages, stealing Eddie Fisher from Debbie Reynolds and dumping Eddie Fisher to run off with the married Richard Burton. She was condemned by the Pope, by the Vatican, for moral vagrancy in that period when she was making Cleopatra. And then she had a near-fatal collapse in London, an emergency tracheotomy. And somehow, because she had faced death and come back from death, she was purged now of her bad behavior, and she was awarded the Oscar for Butterfield 8 for playing a call girl. This is one of the signal days of my life. I will never forget that moment. I was 13 years old when Elizabeth Taylor was given that Oscar. And I rejoiced in the fact that she was delivered from the dead.
That is such an American story. I mean, you see it right now with the story of Martha Stewart, for instance. You know, a woman who's reached iconic status in America, then falls from grace, and lo and behold, we're resurrecting her. She's got out of prison, comes back for a TV show.
Totally. But the thing is, she's a good example of what we've been talking about, because she, you know, was born to this Polish family with lower, you know, middle class and working class roots, and somehow remade herself into an image of WASP perfection, as if she was an heiress of that long line of Connecticut or main line Philadelphia gentry. Right? So she became this exponent of a vanished style in the United States.
It's and not style only that, then she made her living telling other people how to do the same thing. Her books were about remaking yourself.
Yes, I always admired her. Okay, I felt that she was a kind of folk artist in her own way. Here she is, this driven personality, you know, apparently quite tyrannical in private life, and somehow projected her dream. She was almost like the mogul of a Hollywood studio, but it was her world. Right? You know, with all her little invisible serfs, and on TV, there she would be in her program, you know, the Martha Stewart show, you know, just showing this relaxation. She seemed almost sanctified, lit from within by her vision of a life of perfect beauty. But of course, all of it was, there were all these like slaves, you know, that we never saw that did all the actual, you know, work for her. So the thing is, Martha Stewart is a kind of fantasist, okay, but her imagination is so powerful. She's become very beloved. I first realized the extent of the Martha Stewart cult in the early 1990s when I saw her on the Oprah show, and the women who were in the audience were like just screaming fans. They were, most of them were married. The husbands were kind kind of was stunned by this phenomenon. I mean, she really achieved a kind of, you know, canonical status. She became a kind of living saint of the secular world.
But I'm mostly interested in this, the pattern of the stories that we tell about our cultural heroes, about our celebrities. And it seems to me that just as we love people like Martha Stewart, we also have a very strong hunger in this country for fallen idols. I mean, take our obsession with celebrity divorces or any kind of celebrity suffering. You know, the endless stories about Brad and Jen's divorce, Julia's breakup, Michael's trial. You know, it's as though once someone reaches celebrity status in America and enjoys it for a while, there's a sense that we're ready for the next chapter, and the next chapter is going to be the story of their decline.
Well, I think that this is actually not just American. I think this is a universal impulse, and that what we see in this, these celebrity tales, you know, about the travails of you know, Brad Pitt and Jennifer Aniston and Angelina's invasive move into that marriage, I think it's just a version of the old hero sagas. I think you can go around the world and find examples of these in the poetry, okay, of you know, tribal cultures and so on. The famous and the powerful who rise to a peak of visibility and apparent success, enviable success. And then disaster strikes or tragedy strikes, right? And then they're brought low. I think it's a kind of archetypal pattern. People, you know, enjoy this kind of vestigial pattern, I think, in human nature, okay, to idolize, to turn the human into the divine. So you raise people to a great height, but then, okay, if they commit the sin of hubris, if they've just been visible for too long, they have to be slain, okay? And that it's a testing pattern. Mm-hmm. And the truly powerful ones, okay, the ones who truly have some sort of, you know, divine spark in them, they will be able to return from the dead. They will be able to be resurrected. You know, the story of Jesus's resurrection from the dead in the New Testament, you know, is actually a version of what we see in the stories of Dionysus, you know, of the ritual victims being torn to pieces and then fragments of their body being consumed by the worshipers, and then the god somehow mysteriously being reconstituted and returning again, you know, from the grave. It's a pattern. You even see it in the story of Osiris in ancient Egyptian myth, where he is slain and torn to pieces, you know, by his evil brother Seth, and then his good wife and sister, actually Isis, goes around the world collecting the pieces, and then he's magically reconstituted, and it becomes a part of the promise of life in the underworld for the believer.
Camille Paglia is a popular culture critic. Her newest book is called Break, Blow, Burn.
Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life is but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage, and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.
Actor Ian McKellen as Macbeth. On the long list of dastardly historical figures whose images could use a little nip and tuck, Macbeth rates pretty high. The Scottish king got smeared by Shakespeare as a tyrant and murderer, and the image stuck. But now, a group of historians and politicians say that Shakespeare got it wrong. Macbeth was a good guy and a decent king. And some members of the Scottish Parliament have signed a motion calling for Macbeth's achievements to be recognized at long last. Ted Cowan teaches Scottish history at Glasgow University and explains it this way.
Macbeth, some people argue, was born 1,000 years ago in 1005. The famous king immortalized, I suppose, by Shakespeare. And a number of people, actually the originator of this idea was in the United States, or is in the United States, but his ideas have been followed up by some Scottish politicians, and the notion is that we should somehow restore the reputation of Macbeth. We should rescue him from the clutches of the Scribbler of Stratford. And people are beginning getting quite excited about this, or have been quite excited about this.
Of course, you may call him the Scribbler of Stratford, but Shakespeare is pretty well known. It has to have been kind of an uphill battle to rescue Macbeth from him.
Absolutely. I think it's probably a wee bit late for this kind of thing, actually. You know, I think the damage has been done, if it's damage. I mean, historically, we know from the sources that Macbeth was actually quite a good king. He was quite a prosperous king. His best obituary is that in his time there were fertile seasons. And in the Celtic world, that meant that the beneficence, the magnificence of Macbeth's reign was reflected in nature, so that Macbeth was actually regarded as a pretty strong king in his own day. But then the enemy line, the next line who came in as kings, obviously commissioned their bards to blacken his name, and that's exactly what happened. So they turned him into this kind of tyrannical figure, bloodthirsty, trying to kill off his subjects and murder children and all this kind of thing. And that's what Shakespeare saw. It had commercial possibilities, and he certainly manipulated them.
Well, he did. The Shakespearean Macbeth is a murderer of Duncan, the murderer of his friends. He deals with witches. He deals in the occult. His wife is a horror who abets him in all of this. And this is all, you say, the creation of Macbeth's successors?
Yeah, pretty much. It was always a good idea to traduce someone by associating them with witchcraft, because if anybody tried to support that individual so accused, then they were likely to be associated with witches themselves, so you kind of isolated your victim. The Macbeth, the wife, the Lady Macbeth figure, historically was a lady who rejoiced in the name of Gruach, we think, Gruach, and she did live, and she was called the Queen of Scotland while he was King of Scotland. She's actually the first female that we know very much about in Scottish history. But she's gone down, of course, in the books as well as this demon kind of female trying to wash the blood off her hands.
Yeah. Yeah, but there isn't any truth to it? There's the out damned spot should be out damned story?
Yeah, just about, eh?
What do the Scottish people think about this? Do they look at this portrait of Macbeth that Shakespeare purveyed as unfair?
Well, I think most of them don't know about the historical Macbeth. Scots have a pretty poor view of their own history, actually, a very poor understanding of their own history. And most Scots will be familiar with Shakespeare Macbeth, much more so than familiar with any boring historian's account of his reign. This I know to my cost, because I've tried to write about the historical Macbeth for a good number of years now, and most people prefer the play version, I think.
Well, what about the real Macbeth? What do you have to say about him that would make him sound better in the eyes of Scots as a rule?
Well, I think one thing we say about him is that he went off to Rome in the Jubilee year, 1050, where it was said that he scattered grains of sand. He scattered money like grains of sand to the poor, which is unusual for a Scotsman, you know, I have to say. They don't usually go throwing their money around. He came back from Rome and was an even stronger and more munificent king than he had been in the past. So there's all of that. He also managed to hold off English hostilities for 17 years while he ruled, so that was quite an achievement in this particular period. And he conferred an element of prosperity upon his kingdom. That's the idea of the fertile seasons. So, you know, he's quite interesting in his own right here. And the remarkable thing, of course, is that, you know, Shakespeare's Macbeth is a tyrant who has to be destroyed. But in Celtic law, it was always the case that if a king acted tyrannically, then he was deposed by his own subjects. So really, the historical Macbeth would not have needed any lessons from Shakespeare about what was likely to happen to him if he stepped out of line.
What about the reality of his coming to power? Did he kill Duncan? Is there a historical record to show one way or the other?
There's one source which says that Duncan was killed by his lieutenant, Macbeth, Duco Suol, by his war leader, Macbeth. But other sources say just that Duncan was killed by his own people. And it's interesting, though, that some of the sources claim that instead of Duncan being a sort of jolly old buffer, you know, in the castle, that he was killed at an immature age. the idea was that he might have been too young to rule. And in Celtic law, that was allowed. In Celtic law, you had to be mature enough to lead your people in time of war and to counsel them in time of peace. So no minorities were allowed. So I don't want to read too much into it, but there is a possibility here that it was Duncan himself who was some kind of a usurper rather than Macbeth.
What about, I mean, he has to have been mature enough to have a son, though, wasn't he? Because it was Duncan's son who killed Macbeth, or is that not part of the real record either?
It was Duncan's son who killed Macbeth. That's perfectly true. Of course, we don't know how long Duncan had been on the throne, and we Scots are a precocious lot. You know, we father our children at a tender age, so it's quite possible that Duncan was just a teenager, you know, and he still was a father.
Well, does it do any good now, do you think, to resurrect the real Macbeth's image? Isn't the damage done by now?
I think the damage is done. Personally, I don't think it's a particularly big deal. I mean, my personal view is that these things are over and done with in the past. There is really no need to, you know, go through some sort of truth commission on Macbeth or anything like that. I think the time has passed for it. I think the historical record suggests that Macbeth did make a mark, that he was quite a significant ruler, that he combines within his own person many of the interesting aspects of 11th century Scotland, the Celtic past, the Viking past, the Scottish present, and that he managed to resist the English. Unfortunately, he lost out at the end, but that's true of many Scottish kings. So, no, I don't really feel too strongly about the idea that we have to somehow memorialise this guy and take him out of the clutches of Shakespeare. I think, in a way, he can speak for himself.
Well, in fact, though you poo-poo the idea of his connection to the occult, there has been a tradition in the theatre world for years that Macbeth cursed those who did his play. They call it the Scottish play because so many accidents have occurred.
Yeah, that's true. And that's because actors are a superstitious lot, I think.
So what happens with all this now? Do you think that the Scottish Parliament is going to look into redoing Macbeth's history?
I think there'll be a committee which will look at this, and somebody will stand up eventually and say it's a shame that Macbeth was so badly treated by William Shakespeare, and probably everybody will forget about it.
Well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Ted Cowan teaches Scottish history at Glasgow University in Scotland. Coming up, fusion theater. A delusional Scottish king meets a domestic donutaholic from Springfield in the one-man show, Mac Homer.
You pay for this, Mick.
Mac Homer is the name.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
Hostess, we are your guest tonight. Conduct me to mine host. We love him highly and shall continue our graces towards him. Smithers, who wrote this feeble dialogue anyway?
Shakespeare, sir.
Fire the Shakespeare fellow.
I believe he's dead, sir.
Excellent.
An excerpt from Machomer, a theatrical hybrid between Shakespeare's Macbeth and the popular cartoon show The Simpsons. Canadian actor Rick Miller wrote the one-man show and performs it worldwide. He told Steve Paulson that Macomer started as a joke when Miller was a cast member in Macbeth, but it soon became a hit, no matter how unlikely the fusion sounds.
It seems unlikely, unless you're in my head, and then it just seems like the most natural thing in the world. I can justify it by saying it's one dysfunctional family does another, but that's pretty cheap and easy. I think that when you start thinking about the casting and to start fitting certain characters together, you realize it actually fits quite well. Krusty makes a perfect drunken porter, and Homer, being quite a stupid Macbeth, also has ambition and cowardice and laziness. It makes for a very, very interesting take on pop culture. And
well, can you give us a taste of the play?
Sure. Little audio excerpts of MacHomer, A Tale of Sorcery.
Arr, har, when shall we three be meeting again? In thunder, lightning, arr, in rain. Har, 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 har.
When the hurly-burly is done, when the battle is lost and won.
Well, that will be ere they set of sun.
Where the place? Upon the heath.
There to meet with Macbeth.
God, don't say that. It's bad luck.
A Tale of Royalty.
What bloody man is that?
The Thane of Ross, sir.
Hello, I'm the Thane of Ross. You might remember me from other Simpsons Do Shakespeare classics, such as Othello and, Hamlet.
Excellent. No more that Thane of Cawdor shall deceive our bosom interest. Go, pronounce his present death, and with his former title greet,
MacHomer, sir.
MacHomer.
A Tale of Illusion.
Is this a dagger which I see before me?
Or a pizza.
That is wonderful.
Wait, I could go on.
Well, I mean, partly what's just amazing about that is how you switch out of, switch from one character to the other. How do you switch those voices so fast? It's amazing.
Practice. It really is a very strange skill that I have developed. Not only switching from very technically different voices, such as Homer, who is a lower larynx, all right, Homer is down there.
Marge is up here.
And you just go back and forth and have them speak in iambic pentameter, and there you go.
Well, I can kind of see Homer Simpson as Macbeth, I suppose. Homer has that streak of grandiosity in him. But Marge Simpson as Lady Macbeth?
Well, Marge wears the pants in the family. If you really look at things, there are some episodes where Marge flips out, and I can see her being somewhat possessed at times. She's stuck being a housewife, and she occasionally just loses it. So for her to push it one step further is what they might have done in a Simpsons Halloween episode, for instance, where characters get pushed to their extremes. And this is one extended Halloween episode.
So why did you pick Macbeth as opposed to, say, I don't know, King Lear, Romeo and Juliet?
Several reasons. One, I was in Macbeth, and that's the play I knew the best at the time, so that seemed a good decision. The other is Macbeth is quite well known. In terms of its pop culture influence, there are a lot of lines in Macbeth, the "out damn spot out, I say," and "is this a dagger" speech, and there are various others that have resonance in pop culture. As well, Macbeth really is, I think, one of the shortest, if not the shortest, tragedy, and it just suited the play. Everything I decided in terms of the casting and what voice fit with what character, it all fell into place, and it has a great, an anti-hero, or the real hero of the play, Macduff, who is played by Barney. And Barney as Macduff is a fantastic figure because he, in The Simpsons, has this tragic pathos to him. He's this pathetic character who used to be extremely intelligent and very ambitious, and then got seduced by alcohol, and he's this poet struggling in this maybe I'm going too far here, but I think Barney, when he plays Macduff and his family gets slaughtered, there's a wonderful moment in MacHomer where the audience actually very much cares for this character. I don't let it go too far, but they slip into the story, and that's where MacHomer works best, is when it actually is not just parody, it's not just imitation, it actually is a production and a telling of Macbeth in a very different way.
Well, I was going to ask about that because it's tempting to just see this whole thing as a joke. I mean, a rather ingenious joke. After all, you're incorporating something like 50 different characters into the play. But you're saying that you do want to tap into the tragic nobility of Shakespeare.
I think that's only because The Simpsons are such a well-written and a multi-layered show. And I don't think this is pushing it too far. I have had correspondence over the 10 years that I've done the show from people writing doctoral theses and researching, spending their entire academic career trying to figure out why The Simpsons are so popular. And I think part of it has to do with the fact that they work on the level of slapstick, they work on the level of satire, biting satire, parody, as well as the characters are well written. They are developed in such a way that you care about them as well as laugh at them. And South Park, for instance, does not have that quality. South Park is irreverent, but The Simpsons have a heart. And I think that heart makes it suitable to bring in the tragic element.
Now, there are some famous scenes from Macbeth. One of them is the dagger scene, and you've incorporated that into your play. Can you give us a sample?
Sure, I'll do the extended version of what I started before. So,
okay.
Mac Homer has just bid Banquo goodnight and is about to go kill the king, and he sees a dagger in the air, and here's what it sounds like.
Is this a dagger which I see before me?
Or a pizza? Pizza. I see thee still, and on thy blade and dungeon gouge of blood. Where's that tomato sauce? There's no such thing. I go, and it is done. The bell inviteth me. Hear it not, King Duncan, for it is a knell that summons thee to heaven or to that other place.
What's that infernal clanging?
Take that!
Help! Release the hounds! Malcolm!
Shut up!
You'll pay for this, Mick.
Mick Homer is the name!
I have done a deed. And then we go on with where I started before. So that's the rapid-fire version of the dagger scene.
Now, are there certain points in Mick Homer where you actually do feel kind of moved, where it really does go beyond the joke?
It's very difficult acting 50 characters and actually feeling what they go through, because certainly in a dialogue situation where Homer is speaking with Marge, you do feel for, I'll give you an example of a scene that I quite love. It's Marge and Homer, or Macbeth and Lady Macbeth. He's just had a whole monologue where he has basically decided not to kill the king, and he's going to tell his wife that he's reneging on their plans.
How now? What news?
The king has almost supped. Why have you left the chamber?
Well, had he asked for me?
No, you naughty ass.
We will proceed no further in this murdering business. He hath honored me of late, and I have bought golden opinions from all sorts of people, like the guys at Moe's and Banquo, stupid Banquo.
Was the hope drunk when you dressed yourself and blah, 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 and live a coward in thine own esteem?
Yeah, butter's better than cream.
You're not listening.
Prithee, peace. I dare do all that may become a man. Who dares do more is none.
What beast was it that made you break this enterprise to me?
Just to give you an example, that's a scene where Homer is going through quite a bit there, and I would say, yeah, I do feel for him, or I try and convey that, but it's difficult to sink into any actorly emotion when you have to go at that speed and when you have to switch gears completely. So no, I can't say I'm swept away by the emotional curve of Mick Homer, but I do try and convey it as much as possible and get into each single moment.
What do you think Shakespeare would make of your version of Mick Homer?
Would he be rolling in his grave? I don't think so. I think he would have been rather distraught at many of the productions that I've seen. I think he would have loved The Simpsons, personally. The atmosphere that I watched The Simpsons in when I was in college, this rowdy college crowd at the college bar, is, to me, how I imagine Shakespeare's plays were performed in at the Globe. There, of course, were different levels of audience. There was the nobility and the aristocracy, but there were also the groundlings, the hundreds of people who would gather there, and this was what people talked about at the water coolers of the day. And I get rather distraught when I see Shakespeare that is performed in soft seat theaters where most of the audience is just not getting anything and they clap politely at the end and they feel that they've, well, at least they've seen Shakespeare and so now they're on their way to being cultured. And that's not how, to me, Shakespeare should be taken in. It should not be taken in also purely in a classroom situation, too. Shakespeare's meant to be performed. These words were never meant to be studied over and poured the way they are. They were meant to be taken and brought to life. And I think Mick Homer certainly does that.
So why has this happened to Shakespeare? Why has it been turned into this high culture art form when, as you say, Shakespeare really did not intend that, and it wasn't performed that way when he first wrote it?
I think 400 years have passed, and in those 400 years, we speak a different language now. Language seems to me the main barrier, not only the level of sophistication, because there is a lot of sophistication on television, not just The Simpsons, but in a lot of the programs that are out there. It's not all crap, but there's a problem with the language and with a lot of the references within Shakespeare that refer to things that not only happened 400 years ago, but that happened 600 years ago, that people knew then, but that have no relevance to us now. And I think the reason we keep Shakespeare alive and we keep performing it is because the range of human emotion conveyed in Shakespeare's plays, be it jealousy in Othello or ambition in Macbeth or inaction in Hamlet, these are all very real things that we all feel. They're still relevant and they're delivered in such a beautiful poetic way that we still have to keep it alive. But I do think we have to find ways to make it relevant and to communicate to people today.
Rick Miller, author and star of the one-man show Mac Homer. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Coming up, whatever happened to Norma Jean Baker?
Somebody said, what's the difference between Norma Jean and Marilyn Monroe? Why is there this radical split? And I said, you know, in some sense, I don't think there's much more of a difference between her than any 35-year-old movie star and the 16-year-old she once was.
Coming up, the Marilyn Monroe behind the myth. I'm Jim Fleming. That's to the best of our knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. As Elton John put it, Marilyn Monroe was just a candle in the wind, a blonde without much self-determination. Even her film roles made it hard to know where acting ended and Marilyn began.
What's the matter with you anyway?
I'm not very bright, I guess.
I wouldn't say that. Careless, maybe.
No, just dumb. If I had any brains, I wouldn't be on this crummy train with this crummy girl's band.
Well, why'd you take this job?
I used to sing with male bands, but I can't afford it anymore. Have you ever been with a male band?
Who? Me?
That's what I'm running away from. I worked with 6 different ones the last 2 years. Oh, rubbish.
Rough?
I'll say.
You can't trust those guys.
I can't trust myself. I have this thing about saxophone players, especially tenor sax. I don't know what it is, but they just curdle me. All they have to do is play 8 bars or Come to Me, My Melancholy Baby. And my spine turns to custard. I get goose pimply all over. And I come to him.
That's how?
Every time.
You know, I play tennis, I.
But you're a girl, thank goodness.
Oh, yeah.
That's why I joined this band. Safety first. Anything to get away from those bums.
Yeah.
You don't know what they're like. You fall for them, you really love them. You think this is going to be the biggest thing since the Graf Zeppelin. The next thing you know, they're borrowing money from you. They're spending it on other dames and betting on horses.
You don't say.
Then one morning you wake up, the guy's gone, the saxophone's gone. All that's left behind is a pair of old socks and a tube of toothpaste, all squeezed out. So you pull yourself together. You go on to the next job, the next saxophone player. It's the same thing all over again. See what I mean? Not very bright.
Marilyn Monroe as Sugar Cane in Some Like It Hot. We've been talking about the icons of cultural mythology this hour and the endless thirst for reinvention. It may be that no one better underscores these ideas than Marilyn Monroe. She started life as Norma Jean Baker and later ascended the Hollywood ladder and changed her name to Marilyn Monroe. Sarah Churchwell dives into the myths and legends about Monroe in her book, The Many Lives of Marilyn Monroe. Churchwell told Steve Paulson that Monroe was a unique combination of sugar and spice.
Marilyn did famously have the comedy and the sweetness and projected the sense of innocence that made her much more approachable. Norman Mailer, I think, sums it up the best because he was the most kind of caught up in her image. And he says sex was dangerous with others, but it looked like it would be ice cream with her.
Now, one thing that's striking about Marilyn Monroe is that she's been dead for a long time. And yet books keep coming out about her. I mean, there have been, what, something like 600 books written about Marilyn Monroe. It's phenomenal. And, I mean, she's bigger in afterlife, it would seem, than she was when she was living. Or maybe. Who knows? And why, I guess, is the question.
Well, it's sort of the $64,000 question. I mean, it's true that she's been a bigger star for longer now in death than she was when she was alive. She was only a star for a decade, though she was a major star and spanned that entire decade, which I think is important to remember. But, you know, she died in 1962. And one of the things that I found really amazing is how many people know her name, know her face. In all cultures, this isn't just a Western phenomenon. You talk to anybody from Asia or Africa, and they know her name and her image as well. Most of them haven't seen the films. So I do think it's something about her story. It's about the way that her early death seems to conform to these tragic myths. Suddenly, some of our oldest stories, fairy tales and Greek myths and tragedies, come to life in front of our eyes. And one of the things I argue is that she's really more like Snow White, because the fascination with her is when she's, you know, trapped in this glass coffin. We like to look at her when she's still. I think a lot of Marilyn's power still comes from the still photograph. People know those photographs. Or there's a, you know, kind of Lana Turner sort of being discovered story there. And then is, you know, famously desirable and yet can never find happiness. So the story remains open and there's this sense of a search and of a quest that she's always looking for something. She's looking for Mr. Right, or she's looking for her true self. And all of these kinds of quest motifs are often, you know, also very powerful in most of our oldest myths. And then the part that everybody absolutely loves is the idea that, as with any good tragic heroine in Greek myth or in opera, she died for love. She died, supposedly, according to these stories, because she was rejected by the Kennedys. I mean, one of the things that I found so fascinating when I started looking at these stories is that what are supposedly radically opposite explanations for her death, either she deliberately killed herself or she was assassinated, right? Those should be as different as they can be. And yet, all of those stories have the same motive, which is that the Kennedys dumped her. So either way, it doesn't matter whether they, you know, then assassinated her or she killed herself. The idea is that once the love affair goes wrong, then the woman dies. And then, you know, in death, she kind of ascends to the heavens. I mean, it's, you know, Dido and Aeneas or something. I mean, it really is a kind of ancient tale that she seems to be living out.
Well, you mentioned the Kennedys, and there's been so much talk about her supposed affair with Bobby Kennedy in particular, but that, even that is speculation, isn't it? I mean, that's never really been confirmed.
No, it hasn't been at all. That one's very much up for grabs. The only one that people don't dispute very much anymore is JFK, but what they do dispute is how serious that relationship was. For some people, it was a 10-year relationship that began while he was in the Senate and was, you know, the most important relationship in his life. Even some will say more important than with Jackie. Others say it was a 3-day liaison in, you know, Peter Lawford's beach hut. So while they will dispute how serious that affair was, nobody disputes that some kind of relationship happened. But with Bobby, people dispute that very much indeed. And there's a quotation in one of the biographies, which I rather like, because it comes from Dean Martin's ex-wife. Of course, you know, Dean Martin was part of the Rat Pack, and Marilyn was hanging out with them at Peter Lawford's beach house, as I mentioned. So all the usual suspects were there. And Dean Martin's ex-wife, Jeannie, saw a lot of the shenanigans. And she reported later that she became quite convinced that Marilyn was sexually involved with both the Kennedy brothers. But then she said, "But in fact, unless you're in the bedroom, I think it's unfair to presume." And I think that's one of the more sensible things that anybody's ever said about Marilyn. I mean, that unless you actually were, you know, watching, we don't know for sure. And there is good reason to doubt it. So that for me is actually the one that I'm the least, most of the other stories I've at least come to my own kind of conclusions about. But this one, I don't know, I go back and forth to tell you the truth.
Now, one way to look at Marilyn Monroe's life, her career, is to kind of divide it up between Norma Jean, the unknown woman who went to Hollywood and then made it big and then became Marilyn Monroe. And some people say that, well, Marilyn is some kind of fabrication. It's a construction of Hollywood, but the real woman was Norma Jean.
Yeah, that's a really favorite story. And actually, a lot of my book is about trying to take apart that story because I find it really problematic for several reasons. certainly Marilyn Monroe in some ways was an invention. I mean, she's an invented name, although, as I point out in my book, Monroe had more claim to be a real surname because it was her mother's maiden name, and nobody knows who her biological father was. So her mother actually made up the last name on her birth certificate, which was Mortensen. It wasn't even Baker. So this Norma Jean Baker name that has evolved is actually a very complicated name, whereas Monroe really was her mother's name. So in some ways we could say, well, actually that name makes better sense. But yeah, I mean, what happens is the name changes and then, you know, her hair goes platinum blonde and this look evolves and it's a very static look. Marilyn Monroe became a very static image. So it's very easy to say, yeah, that's a mask. It's a tomb in which, you know, poor Norma Jean is, you know, sealed up and there's this real woman buried under this terrible fetish mask of Marilyn Monroe and we need to lift off the mask somehow and reveal the real woman. My problem with that story is, first of all, that it doesn't allow for the possibility that somebody could evolve. I actually said the other day, you know, somebody said, what's the difference between Norma Jean and Marilyn Monroe? Why is there this radical split? And I said, you know, in some sense, I don't think there's much more of a difference between her than any 35-year-old movie star and the 16-year-old she once was. I mean, she became a different person because she grew up, because her circumstances changed, because she suddenly became incredibly rich and incredibly desirable, and, you know, her world changed. So as a consequence, she changed with that. My other problem with the what I call the Norma Jean story is that it's actually very, very sentimental about Norma Jean, and it suggests that there's something quite wonderful about Norma Jean, this ordinary real woman, and that she's the one that we want to recover.
Well, and it's also interesting how Marilyn got caught up in certain controversies. For instance, her marriage to Joe DiMaggio and then how it fell apart. And she was often blamed for that. I mean, first of all, there's the question of, you know, who are we to pass judgments on someone else's marriage? But even though there are reports that DiMaggio was not that nice a fellow, that he probably beat her, and yet somehow she's been held accountable or responsible for the failure of that marriage.
Absolutely, and for the failure of the marriage with Miller. I mean, a lot of the biographies actually lay the blame for her inability to have children, and they say that it was her failure to be a whole woman that made these marriages fall apart, which I find an unbelievably misogynistic explanation. So, you know, a woman's wholeness is predicated on her ability to bear children. So, I mean, I think that, you know, any woman who's not a mother might find that a little bit troubling. The notion that women are to blame is, of course, you know, a fairly tried and true explanation for a lot of the world's problems. I mean, go back to the Trojan War. You know, there's always a woman at fault somewhere. But yeah, I also think, again, it's this tendency to see everybody around her as normal and Marilyn as somehow anomalous or an aberration. So Joe DiMaggio's alleged violence gets explained away. And they say things like, yeah, but he was, you know, he was an old school Italian-American. He expected his wife to be home making pasta. And so it's not that surprising that he slapped her around a little bit. So they'll have all these excuses for him. And then she is this freak show that nobody can explain, who has these terrible, you know, huge problems that nobody could possibly rise above. Instead of, as you say, just acknowledging that maybe we shouldn't pass judgment on other people's marriage and say it went wrong for the reasons that many marriages go wrong.
Now, one thing that's striking about the story of Marilyn Monroe is how it almost seemed that she became this template. I'm thinking about Elton John's song Candle in the Wind, which was written about Marilyn Monroe. But what we remember, the reason we remember that song today is that it was played at Princess Diana's funeral. I mean, again, it plays into that image of Marilyn or Diana being the victim. I mean, if there's that
Absolutely.
Line, they made you change your name.
Yeah.
And, you know, as if
these
women
were treadmill.
Right, were really not in control of their lives.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's why I find that particular story and that particular song so nauseating, because it doesn't actually allow for the fact, which we know to be facts, that both Diana and Marilyn worked very hard at manipulating their own media. They were trying to be powerful. They may or may not have pulled it off. But the idea that they were passive victims or puppets who somebody else set in motion is clearly not the case. And again, I think assumes some very disturbing things about women, that any woman who's in that position couldn't have wanted to get there and couldn't have made any moves to get there, that they have no ability to determine their own fate. Part of the problem is this tendency to see people in absolute terms. So they're either all good or all bad, they're all manipulative or they're all passive. And again, I would go back to this idea of, you know, she could be nice one day and nasty the next. One can be powerful in some circumstances and then lose power in other circumstances.
You end your book with a chapter called My Marilyn. Who is your Marilyn?
ultimately, my Marilyn is an ordinary person in the sense that I think that she was psychologically ordinary. I don't think she was insane. I don't think that she was a monster. I don't think that she was a saint. I think that she was a person. And she had certain talents and skills, and she was trying to use them to the best of her ability to live up to what was probably a quite extraordinary amount of ambition.
Truman Capote had a great story about Marilyn Monroe. Can you tell us that one?
Yeah, I actually like Truman Capote's. He has a couple of very funny anecdotes, some of which are too rude for me to repeat on the radio, but which I like a lot. They come from the years that Marilyn spent in New York. They were friends and apparently taking some drugs together as well. And Capote was also friends with Elizabeth Taylor, who was Marilyn's great rival at 20th Century Fox. And the two women didn't know each other very well. And so according to Capote, Marilyn asked him what Elizabeth Taylor was like. And he said, she's a little bit like you. She wears her heart on her sleeve and talks salty. And then Marilyn said, well, if somebody asked you, what was I really like, what would you say? And he said he'd have to think about that. But for me, he'd already answered the question a little bit in saying that she, you know, talked salty and wore her heart on her sleeve. And that goes back to this idea of my Marilyn, of the kind of Marilyn that I would want to try to imagine or that I'm interested in looking at. That idea of somebody who talks salty and wears her heart on her sleeve is to me different from the cliche of the innocent, vulnerable sex pot. There's a different spin on it there, where if she talks salty, there's something that's more adult about that. There's something that's more ribald and that's funnier. But also then the sense that he doesn't use the word vulnerable. You know, to say that she wears her heart on her sleeve seems to me to say more that this is somebody who's living by her emotions, both of which, when you put them together, strike me as being a picture of an adult woman I can imagine, instead of this endlessly, you know, kind of stunted, perennially adolescent little girl that Marilyn is supposed to have been. So I like the Capote stories. They make me laugh.
Sarah Churchwell. She's the author of the book The Many Lives of Marilyn Monroe. Steve Paulson spoke with her. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Steve Paulson, Veronica Rickert, Ann Strange Champs, Charles Monroe Kane, Mary Lou Finnegan, Doug Gordon, and John Peterson, with engineering help from Kirill Owen. You can buy a tape of this program by calling the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Myths and Makeovers, number 51A. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. We always love to hear from you.
PRI, Public Radio International.